Hi there, welcome to IASB Update. This is a short summary of the meeting of the IASB, which took place between the 22nd and the 24th of September 2014 here at our offices on Cannon Street in London. My name is Chris Welsh, I'm Communications Manager for the IASB, and I'm joined today by Stephen Cooper, a member of the IASB, and Alan Tashira, who's Senior Technical Director here at the IASB. Without further ado, Alan, I think the first topic of conversation on our agenda was the disclosure initiative.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. As people are aware, the disclosure initiative is important for us in terms of improving quality of financial reporting more generally. So we had a look at a couple of issues this week. These are education sessions, so there was no decision making by the board. They were dealing with a couple of quite difficult topics related to materiality. And what we've done is essentially we went out and contacted a lot of national standards setters and regulators because the concept of materiality is not just used in accounting standard setting, but it's used in auditing, for example. It's used in regulatory environments. So we're trying to get a better understanding of how materiality is perceived, understood and applied in different jurisdictions. And just to give a sense of the flavour, we have a definition of materiality within our framework. In the US, which is a large jurisdiction, their materiality is a word used in one of their acts, and it's their Supreme Court has defined materiality. So we have different ways that the term has actually evolved over time. We're trying to understand how these things interact. We have a range of ways that people apply it. In one jurisdiction, for example, they have thresholds of 2.5% of revenue. Anything below above that is deemed to be material. And in one jurisdiction, they even have a specify in their local currency. Any item above that specified amount is deemed to be material. So we had a look at that more generally to understand the sources, what the main tensions were. And really what this will ultimately lead to is the board will be asked how it wants to respond. Should it amend the definition? And there are some little issues in there that they could think about. At least, at the very least, we make sure that we have one cohesive definition within IFRS. At the moment, we've got some slight differences between our framework and the way it's described in two of our standards. They're not substantive at all, but it's never helpful to have slightly different wording.
Sure.
The other is whether we should produce some sort of, and I use the word loosely, guidance. In other words, how should we elaborate to tell people how to apply the concept of materiality, and do we need to? Mm. And the challenge for us is the more we explain how to apply it, the more we might end up conflicting or coming up against some well-established regulatory implementation. So we're looking at both the nature of the guidance and also what form it should take. Essentially, it was a long PowerPoint presentation the board had a look at that's available for people to pull off our website. We're going to take that back in November, where we'll have a full paper with the starting to put the recommendations for how we proceed there. Related to that, one of the areas we think where materiality is not well applied, and perhaps it's something we can do something about, is in the area of the accounting policies. We've heard from many sources that you get 6 or 7 pages of policies, they're very boilerplate. They often do a very good job of paraphrasing what the standard says, and they often use the major firms to summaries of the standard. And how helpful is that? And one of the problems potentially is that our own standards, IS1 and IS8, they're two standards that deal with it. Perhaps they don't give as clear an indication to a preparer as to what makes a policy relevant or whether what makes it material. So we're looking to see whether we should do something to help with our drafting, make it a little bit easier to apply materiality to that. So we had an introductory discussion with that. It was a good debate for those who want to listen to the recording of it. It shows it's not going to be that easy a job. So this is going to be a separate chapter within the principles of disclosure discussion paper. We're not likely to push ahead and do any sort of short-term work on that at the moment. Perhaps the other two quick things on this is that we are putting together the final stages of an exposure draft to deal with disclosure. I'll use the term net debt because people are familiar with that, but essentially it's to require some disclosure about reconciliation around financing, and it's coming off our cash flow statement standard. So this is in response to users who find it difficult to understand some of the financing flows. So that exposure draft we expect to have out this year. And we're also having, as part of that, a look at some language around, I guess, restrictions or barriers to being able to use the cash when and where required. For example, whether it's because you have to pay some sort of tax to transfer the money, or you've got some sort of foreign currency restrictions. So we're having a look at that as well. Yeah, I think it's quite a lot. It was a busy session.
Okay, well, obviously lots more to come on that, so we look forward to further updates from subsequent meetings. Stephen, over to you. Insurance contracts.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. So on insurance this month, we had some decision-making relating to the premium allocation approach and some education and further discussion, but no decisions related to participate contracts with participating features. So on the premium allocation approach, we did one clarification and one change from something that we had in the exposure draft. The clarification related to how one should recognize revenue under the premium allocation approach, and in particular how you should allocate the premium to the various different periods of coverage. And we said that an entity that applies the premium allocation approach should recognize insurance contract revenue on the basis of the passage of time, effectively straight line, but if the expected pattern of release of risk differs significantly from the passage of time, then we would say use the basis of the expected timing of incurred claims and benefits. And this, I think, essentially is a clarification, but it's an area that perhaps wasn't so clear in the exposure draft. The change that we made relates to the situation where you use the other comprehensive income approach for dealing with discount rate changes for the claims liability under the premium allocation approach. Once you get to the liability for incurred claims, then the same methodology for measuring the liability is applied as we have in the building block approach, the general approach. And if you don't use OCI, then there's no difficulty because you would just always discount at the current rate to measure that liability. The problem arises when you use the other comprehensive income approach and you identify a locked-in discount rate, a fixed discount rate, and then apply that to measuring the profit and loss. And then the difference between that and the current up-to-date rate then appears in accumulated other comprehensive income. In the exposure draft, we specified that the discount rate should be the rate at the time of the inception of the contract, which was consistent with the basis that we had for the general approach, the building block approach. Many said that that was operationally challenging, and the board, as a result of the feedback, and largely for cost-benefit reasons, changed to what many in the comment letters asked for, which is the discount rate that applies at the time when the liability arises, so when the claims liability, the liability for incurred claims arises. And that essentially to simplify and avoid companies having to track the discount rate from the inception of the contract. So the other aspect that we discussed was for contracts with participating features, and this is another set of meetings that has been going on now for a few months and will continue as well before we come to final decision making on this. And this time we discussed the area of book yield and effective yield. Now, this also relates to other comprehensive income, and how and whether one should use other comprehensive income for these contracts with participating features. The methodology that we have for the non-par contracts with the locked-in discount rate doesn't really work for the contracts with participating features because of this link to the underlying items. So it's a question of how it should be modified, whether it should be modified, And there are two proposals, a book yield approach and an effective yield approach. I won't go into a discussion of those here. People are interested, then I think the staff papers provide a pretty good explanation of the background and the rationale behind those approaches and the mechanics. So I think people will find those pretty accessible as more detailed explanations. But the board had a good discussion on the relative merits of each of those. There are advantages and disadvantages of each of the two approaches, and I think the board discussion brought out those advantages and disadvantages pretty clearly. The staff will be doing more work on these types of contracts, and in particular in the future we're going to return to these to discuss the so-called unlocking of the CSM issue and whether there should be further adjustments to the contractual service margin to deal with changes in the underlying contracts which relate to the investments held, the underlying items, changes related to options and guarantees. So there'll be further discussion on this in a future meeting. That does interact with the OCI decision, the effective yield and book yield, which is why we didn't make any decisions about whether we would use one or the other in this case, because we really need to look at the whole range of issues to do with participating contracts and decide exactly what the overall accounting model is going to look like. Before we can do that, we have to really make sure that we've understood all of the different components, which is the reason for these education sessions.
Thank you very much. As I say, further deliberations in the October meeting, hopefully. So moving on, the conceptual framework, obviously this is a very broad topic, so I think we're going to split it into three distinct sections today. So Alan, I think you were going to start with measurement.
No, I think I was going to start with measurement, but I'd imagine you can do it if you like.
between the two of you, no. I think.
Yeah, well, I'll do a better job anyway. So measurement. There was quite a very interesting discussion on measurement. It's going to have to come back again in the next month. But essentially, the board is trying to do is to see if they can develop a sensible way of categorising different measurement bases, because we have lots of different ways of describing. You've got the initial amount you might pay for something, and then you might have depreciation or amortization, so you adjust the prices. Mm-hmm. What happens then if you then move to something like a fair value? And so you can think of those as being historical or current values. And then you ask the question, what if you update some cash flows, for example, in an estimate, or you impair something? Have you now moved to an adjusted historical cost, or have you actually moved to a current? And we're trying to see if we're going to get a sensible categorization here, so that then within a categorization, you can try and minimize the number of, or get some consistency about the way you do the measurements, for example. I don't think we're quite there yet. The board's asked the staff to go back and have a look at the categorization process. And in particular, they're going to make sure that we describe an amortized cost as an historical cost measurement basis. So a little bit of work to do on the categorization. I guess some good progress, though, perhaps on a couple of other aspects. One is the selection approach. Now, you've got to remember this is concepts, so this is not going to be driving individual asset and liability ones at this stage. You've got to, when you develop a standard, consider the objective financial reporting, the qualitative characteristics. So that means you might have a look at things like how the asset or liability contributes to future cash flows. That could depend on the nature of a business. You look at the characteristics of the asset or liability, how much cash flows might vary by, the sensitivity of the value, for example. Have a look at the relative importance of each of those factors. So you've got perhaps a lot of sensitivity around the valuation versus a more robust measure, but perhaps there's more information content in the sensitive estimate. That's the sort of thing the board has to do. And it's obviously going to vary standard by standard or asset by asset. So the framework will provide, I guess, the basis for the factors to think about. The actual decision making will happen at the standards level. So when the board actually sets a standard, those are the things that it'll actually think about. And that's supposed to lead to more consistent measurement attribute selection. I want to emphasize one thing. By embedding or putting those things into a framework, it doesn't automatically lead to any changes at all in the measurement basis in our standards. This is for when we go ahead and amend any standards later on. The other is just a few things on initial measurement. We've got there's some drafting changes we're going to do to the framework, but I want to mention that the board noted essentially that measurement basis using an initial recognition should be consistent with the measurement basis that you use subsequently. So there should be a sense of the two tie up. So more to come, I think, in next month on measurement.
Okay, thank you very much. So Stephen, sorry, I stole your thunder for the last category. Maybe you'd like to take us through long-term investing.
Sure, okay. Long-term investment has been a subject that many people have raised, some investors, others. Part of the problem with this is that people often mean two different things by it. It is long-term investment by a reporting entity, so buying long-term securities, for example, or it is investors in a reporting entity that have a long-term perspective and that are likely to keep their investment for some time and may perhaps have different requirements as users as a result. So we had a staff paper that discussed both aspects of that. And the specific question is whether what we are developing in the conceptual framework is sufficient to deal with those two issues. So obviously if an entity has long-term investments, we have to have an appropriate method of accounting that is going to provide useful and relevant information to investors about the long-term investments that the entity makes. And we need an appropriate measurement approach, we need an appropriate presentation approach, including potentially the use of other comprehensive income that is going to provide that useful, relevant information. So the question is whether what we're proposing in the measurement chapter that Alan was talking about, whether the objectives of financial reporting, whether the presentation requirements or principles that we're going to have in the framework are sufficient to deal with this long-term investment activity. And the other aspect is then the users of financial statements. So if you have an investor who has a long-term horizon, and whether the information that's going to be provided by financial statements based upon this framework, whether that's going to satisfy the information needs of that investor. So focusing in the framework on relevance and faithful representation and all the other things, is that appropriate for those long-term investors? And I think the conclusion that the board reached was that the work that we're doing on the framework does sufficiently take into account those two aspects, that there is nothing in addition on top of what we're already doing that we need to focus on in order to satisfy the information needs from those two perspectives. It's not that we don't think that long-term investment and long-term investors are unimportant. I think most of us on the board think that this is very important and that we should be providing appropriate information for those investors, and we should make sure that businesses, for example insurance companies that have themselves long-term investments, that financial reporting needs to fully reflect those activities and fully reflect those investors' information needs. But I think that's something that we are already doing within the framework discussions. So the purpose of this was to try and identify whether we needed some additional work, and I think the board was satisfied that what we're already doing on the framework is sufficient for those particular activities.
Great, thank you very much. So our third and final topic within conceptual framework discussions were liabilities and equity.
Yeah, and probably not without controversy as well. I think all the topics always, these are hard topics. Liabilities, equity, it's as people will probably be aware, we're proposing some amendments to the definition of a liability, so we change that slightly. Most of our discussion, or a lot of discussion so far, is focused on, and it's very hard to see obviously on a podcast, but extending the boundaries in terms of have we drawn the line or given people enough guidance to identify whether something is a liability, and dealing with particularly the uncertain things like the lawsuits, and we have a standard IS 37 that deals with these difficult to you know, do you or do you not have a liability issues? And we focused a lot on that, so that's drawing that boundary. The other one is the line then between something that is a debt as opposed to an equity. So there's that sort of split between the two. The board was asked to consider whether or not they should, at the ED phase now for the conceptual framework, look at some amendments to the definition that would try to implement a combined settlement valuation approach for distinguishing between debt and equity. And they had a look at that and decided not to make any amendments to the definition, in other words, not put into the ED at this stage. Now, we've got to be very careful with the messages. Doesn't mean we're not going to do work on liability definition, liability equity split. We have a parallel project, we call it a research project, that's looking at IS 32, which is our standard that deals essentially with that. And we're going to continue to work on that to see if we can identify and make some good conceptual decisions about how to identify equity. I think the open question is then how that would then potentially feed back into the framework, which we've always perceived as being a living document, and it's just a matter of people understanding that we're not abandoning that that important problem, because we have had a lot of issues going to our interpretations committee, and we think we have a problem now. We almost don't have a basis for interpreting on some of these quite complex instruments, so we do have to address it, and we are going to work on that in parallel with the framework.
Thank you very much. Finally, I guess, just a quick update on the post-implementation review of IFRS 3.
Yep, I think that's me again. We had a session on the post-implementation review. We had a request for information, a lot of comments received, very helpful comments. Essentially, this was just giving the board an overview and summary of what we did. There are probably three issues to me that are probably the most controversial or came up for people to express some strong views on. One is the definition of a business, and that's because we have different accounting for a group of assets compared to a business, so it matters, and people are concerned about that. So they'd like us to try and address, either clarify what a business is or deal with the differences. Yeah. Second one is goodwill and goodwill amortization. Mm-hmm. We only have an impairment model for goodwill. We don't amortize goodwill anymore. And some people are questioning whether that's a good thing. Now, the issue is, are they challenging the impairment test and saying maybe the impairment test needs to be looked at, or should we reintroduce amortization? Mm-hmm. And I think that's going to be one of the more controversial aspects of it. Right. Intangible assets as well, you pull a lot more intangible assets out of goodwill under the IFRS 3 than you did pre-2008. So that's another area as well where I think we've got quite a few comments. We also at the same time in parallel have an academic review, so we can see what's happening in terms of information that the markets might impound about business combinations and so on. And it's particularly interesting because on the goodwill side, they're saying there is incremental information in the impairments and there's extra value relevance in goodwill, and perhaps over and above the number it used to be before we introduced the standard. So that gives a bit of comfort that we actually maybe have made the right decisions when it was introduced. Having laid out all the feedback generally, the staff asked whether or not the board was satisfied that they had enough information to prepare a feedback statement, and that's really the next step.
Okay.
Is that we'll prepare a formal feedback statement that the board will then basically deliberate and publish, and it's from there that we will decide whether we should do anything at all or whether we need to do the odd little annual improvement, for example, and so on. But that's an open question at the moment.
Okay, thanks, Alan. Very much appreciated, and thank you, Stephen, for joining us today. So summer is well and truly over here in London. It's been a very, very busy few weeks. So not only did we have the meeting of the ISB last week, we also had the September meeting of the Interpretations Committee the week before. Details of that can be found on our website. If you go to the Stay Informed tab, you should be able to download IFRIC Update, which is a comprehensive a summary of the proceedings of the IFRIC meeting. in a similar way, you can download the ISB update, which will give you a comprehensive summary of the ISB meeting in the same place. Just go to the top navigation and stay informed. Last week, we also were lucky enough to host again the World Standard Setting World Standard Setters meeting. It's an annual event comprising of about 130 delegates from around the world. So lots of positive discussions there. Also, the meeting of IFAS, which ran a few days after that. So all in all, a very busy few weeks in the world of accounting standard setting. The trustees of the IFRS Foundation are also going to meet next week even, for their quarterly meeting, and that's taking place in Mexico City. All of the meetings will be posted online. There should be a live web feed from Mexico as well. So if you want to keep up to date with goings-on in Mexico City, then just do so via the ISB website. Just a quick reminder that all opinions expressed today are those of the presenters and do not necessarily represent those of the ISB. But on that note, I'd like to thank you all for joining us, and we'll speak again next month.